The Truth Village, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. North and South Korean officials plan to meet for talks next week in the neutral zone between the two countries. Both sides actually take tourists there.
You know, the South Korean side wants to show just how dangerous it is and how they're protecting the country. And the North Korean side, strangely, it's much more, look how the South is dividing us from the North.
Also, the USS Pakistan needs to do more to fight terrorism.
Just to blame everything on us and say that we're the reason this war isn't being won is ridiculous.
Plus, mariachi fans, does this sound familiar?
I saw many of the same songs get played in the same way by every mariachi band and every Mexican restaurant that has a mariachi.
But Omar Nera decided to change that. It's all ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being here this Friday. A lot to get to in this edition of the show, and we're going to start in Pakistan, a country described for years as a U.S. ally in the fight against terrorism. But there's big news on that front this week. The Trump administration has decided to suspend at least $900 million in security assistance to Pakistan. The reason? The State Department says Pakistan is not doing enough to fight terror groups on its territory. In fact, President Trump has accused Islamabad of, quote, giving safe haven to the terrorists we hunt in Afghanistan, end quote. In a minute, the impact freezing this money will have on security in the region. First, though, we're going to hear how people in Pakistan are reacting to this news.
Well, I think disappointment and frustration.
Beena Shah is a Pakistani writer, columnist, and blogger. She spoke with us from Karachi.
I don't think that it's easy for any country to do 100% when you're faced with the kind of situation that we are faced with. And it's not like the signs weren't there that this was coming. But I think just to have the hammer lowered on us, it's been a little bit of a rough ride.
I mean, Donald Trump is the one who is pulling the dollars, but this was a critique, the ineffectiveness of Islamabad on terrorists. It was a critique during the Obama administration, too. I mean, if Pakistan isn't doing enough, what is wrong with pulling the aid?
Pakistan cannot win this war for the United States. That's the first thing to realize. The war is continuing in Afghanistan for a number of factors, only one of which might be the existence of safe havens on both sides of the border for miscreants, for extremists and militants who can easily escape from one side to the other. That is a problem that needs to be addressed, but the Afghanistan side refuses to recognize that line. It's the Durand line. It's not even a firm border. So we're stuck with a stalemate there. Second of all, there are so many internal factors. There's so many things going on in Afghanistan. Warlords and tribal parties are fighting for power, for control. The Taliban is stronger than ever. It controls more territory than ever. It's powered by the money that it earns from the heroin trade, from the poppy crops that it grows. This is not Pakistan's problem. So I think just to blame everything on us and say that we're the reason this war isn't being won is ridiculous.
So Beena, there in Karachi where you are, what are you hearing in the media there and from other Pakistanis about this suspension of aid?
I think the same sort of frustration and disappointment that I expressed to you myself on a personal level. And there's the reassurance of China behind us to say that, well, you know, this isn't going to affect your economy adversely, but it's still going to have a very bad effect on the stability of the region.
Yeah, I'm also reading that China is kind of prepared to step in and provide assistance if it's needed in Pakistan. Personally, Beena, how does this money affect you on a daily basis? Like, have you felt safer in Pakistan because the U.S. has been providing the security assistance?
There's a lot of assistance the United States has been providing. It hasn't just been about, you know, fighting a war in Afghanistan. It's been about training our security forces, training our police in many ways, increasing surveillance at the airports. There are a lot of factors that have been instrumental to making Pakistan, and at least my city, Karachi, a safer place or a safer feeling place. Deaths due to terrorism have dropped in the last several years. That is in large part due to our own military operations that are continuing in our territory. The United States has helped with all of those things as allies and friends and partners should do. This is just really a sad turn of events for all of us.
So, I mean, given that kind of tough relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan over the years, how do you envision like a good relationship between these two countries?
I mean, I think that, first of all, the people that are making these decisions need to listen more to the very real fact that Pakistan feels insecure, surrounded by unfriendly countries. It doesn't feel like it is in a good position vis-a-vis its own internal security. The United States needs to really acknowledge that fact, not just what we've been doing for them or not doing for them in the war on terror. If that basic understanding can be made, I think things could at least be normalized, if not returned to that very favorable situation that we had hoped to see before.
Pakistani writer and blogger Beena Shah speaking there from Karachi. Let's focus now on what this suspension of U.S. aid to Pakistan could mean on the ground in the fight against extremist groups like that are active in the country, like al-Qaeda, ISIS, and the Haqqani Network. Ayesha Siddiqa is a Pakistani military expert and a research associate at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. That's where we reached her via phone. So Pakistan is going to lose anywhere from $900 million to $1.3 billion. Remind us what that money currently goes to.
Well, that money is for basically whatever Pakistani military spends on a war against terror as part of the American coalition. So whatever services are provided, that's a reimbursement for that.
So if we use the round figure of $1 billion, do you know what percentage of Pakistan's military budget that accounts for?
That would not be a huge proportion there because it's going towards not major weapon systems, but electronics, etc. So I would estimate that this is 4 to 5% of the defense budget, nothing more. The $1 billion is not a huge amount.
So what will that actually affect then? How do you see this playing out? Like what's not going to happen as a result of this, say, $1 billion frozen?
I don't think it really get affected because if Pakistan has to fight a war on terror, it's to secure itself. So the money would come from the budget, and it's happened in the past as well. Let me remind you that it's been the third time that there have been sanctions against Pakistan. And every time there is a sanction, Pakistan tries to fill the gap through using its own resources. But the other thing which it hopes to do is get some money from China. One window is open if the American window shuts. It's looking for a reliable partner, especially when the United States has chosen India over Pakistan in Afghanistan. And the point here is that it's not just that Pakistan needs American money, it's also that America needs Pakistan, especially when Donald Trump has increased the number of troops in Afghanistan. America needs supply line, and that supply line goes through Pakistan. So at some point in time, although aid has been discontinued and Pakistan's foreign minister has said that this is the end of the alliance, I think they'll have to go back to the drawing board and negotiate a bit more.
So the U.S. State Department has said this frozen security money is supposed to be an incentive for Pakistan to take action, not a punishment. If Pakistan just turns to China, how do you think the United States will read that?
Pakistan has already been pushed into China's lap. And of course, that's not going to make Donald Trump very excited. But I think that's what the game is right now. China and Pakistan are much stronger allies than Pakistan and United States. And the signal from Pakistan is that you can't treat us like this. I mean, I think the greater concern is not the $1 billion that have been cut off. It's the humiliation.
So when Pakistan's foreign minister says the U.S. is treating his country like a whipping boy, it's about respect. It's not about that $1 billion.
Yeah, it's not really about money. It's you can't treat me like that. Pakistan will continue with whatever it thinks is in its interest. And the responsibilities in both states, Pakistan and United States, to find a middle ground.
So there was word from a White House official today that the frozen aid could actually be much closer to $2 billion when all is said and done. What's your opinion? I mean, if Pakistan seems to be struggling for whatever reason to crack down on militants, isn't the U.S. not getting its money's worth? And shouldn't the assistance at least be drawn down until Pakistan has some results to show for it?
Well, that's a fair assessment, but we have reached a point where I don't think Pakistan is willing to do more.
Ayesha Siddiqa is a research associate at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. The White House is expressing doubts, but let's see what happens next Tuesday when North Korean officials are going to meet with South Korean officials for the first time in over 2 years to discuss the Winter Olympics. They'll be meeting in the town of Panmunjom in the Demilitarized Zone. Panmunjom is historic. It's where the armistice was signed in 1953 that brought fighting in the Korean War to an end, although not an actual end of the war itself. These days, it's kind of a tourist destination, a dangerous tourist destination. It's been called the most tense place on the planet. But hey, it's got 4.5 stars on TripAdvisor, so what are we waiting for? Isaac Stonefish, a senior fellow at the Asia Society, has been there many times over the past several years. So how did Panmunjom become what it is today, Isaac?
I think after the end or the cessation of the Korean War, both sides wanted to use it as a propaganda tool to show how much better their way of life was than the other side. And both sides regularly, especially the South Korean side, take tourists there. And they both want to demonstrate a different message. Now, the South Korean side wants to show just how dangerous it is and how they're protecting the country. And the North Korean side, strangely, it's much more, look how the South is dividing us from the North. But it was much less tense on the North Korean side.
Mm. So the city limits of Panmunjom are shared by both North and South Korea?
Yes.
Describe for us what a trip there was like for you. How did you actually get there?
So you take a tourist bus from Seoul, and when I went, they made us sign something that said basically our life was in our own hands, and we were given a lot of speeches about the danger of the zone. Conversely, going from the North Korean side, it was an almost festive experience. And North Korea is a very, very tense place to visit, and I'm sure a much tenser place to live in, but the DMZ felt almost like a party, almost like, hey, this is us defending our country, and everyone just look over at the other side, smile, have a good time.
So you've been to Panmunjom coming at it from the South Korean side and the North Korean side?
Been to the DMZ from both sides. I don't remember if I made it to Panmunjom from the north side, but I've definitely been to the DMZ from both the south and the north, and they certainly don't make you sign anything on the north side. They don't really have the same ideas of liability and responsibility they do up there than they do in the south.
Once you're in Panmunjom on the DMZ, is there any divider between the north and the south? Like, can you actually meet North Korean troops there?
So when you're in the room at the center of the DMZ, there's a line that goes through it. And one part of the room is the North Korean side, one part of the room is the South Korean side. They alternate allowing tourists from either sides to go in. And then you're allowed to walk around the room. So sort of like being in the embassy of a foreign country, you know, you cross the border over to the North Korean side, even if it's just 4 or 5 feet.
Absolutely fascinating. So what else is there to see in Panmunjom?
I remember they showed us a golf course or a golf. I think it was just maybe a golf hole where people can play golf. And there's some sort of superlative attached to it, maybe the most dangerous golf course in the world. And on the North Korean side, I remember it was a pretty good opportunity to pick up souvenirs. There were people selling trinkets.
Oh.
Yeah, I think there was people on the side of the road, just sort of rare in North Korea, selling little keychains, I think, and ginseng candies and silkscreen prints and booze. They were very big on the booze. So a lot of opportunity to buy North Korean ginseng alcohol and I think a snake bile alcohol too, some sort of strange kind of alcohol that I decided not to risk my life on. Would have been dangerous.
The website TripAdvisor gave Panmunjom the whole visit 4.5 stars. You agree with that?
I think that's a good ranking. Yeah, I think on the North Korean side, I'd give it 5 stars. The South Korean side felt a little bit too artificially tense.
Huh. What would you say is the difference between the North Koreans and the South Koreans you met on these two tours and why they go to Panmunjom?
So we weren't allowed to interact with any North Korean tourists while we were there. And I think the ones who do go probably are taken to show what the South Koreans have done to them and how the South Korean brothers are keeping the nation divided because of the imperialistic and overbearing Americans. And I think the South Koreans go more for a sense of curiosity, a sense of history, and a sense of trying to understand why the situation is like it is.
Isaac Stonefish, a senior fellow at the Asia Society, thanks very much for telling us about Panmunjom.
Thank you, Marco. Great to chat.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to the world. When I visit the BBC World Service in London, I overhear some incredible conversations. No surprise there. You've got journalists from across the globe every day reporting the news in dozens of different languages. That's why, as I've told you before, one of my favorite BBC podcasts is The Fifth Floor. Now, the World's office is on the fourth floor of the BBC. The fifth floor is where the language services are based. And on this week's episode of The Fifth Floor, three BBC journalists from Iran sat down to talk about the ongoing protests in their country. World Service reporter Farhanak Amidi led the conversation.
There have been protests in more than 50 different towns and cities all over the country. Many of my colleagues and I have been amazed at how widespread and spontaneous these protests have been. I spoke to BBC Monitoring's Arash Ahmadi and from BBC Persian's social media and interactive team, Roja Asadi, to find out how these protests all began.
There are deep underlying reasons for the protests. Mainly they are economic. These young, unemployed people, they see the huge difference in wealth gap. I'm sure you're aware that Tehran has got one of the highest number of Maserati and Porsche drivers who go around the flashier parts of Tehran driving fast with their cars. And of course, you've heard about the plastic surgery in Iran. That's not for the ordinary people. That's not for the working classes. So they see this around them. They see this inequality. And of course, that has angered them.
Roger, I saw you were nodding and agreeing with Arash on many of these issues. What do you think has made these protests a bit more unusual from the previous one, for example, from the one in 2009?
Yeah, I was thinking why you used the term unusual. That time, people really main concern was political issues. Mm-hmm. They thought that they voted for someone, but someone else came out of the ballot box. And this time, political wasn't at all the main concern of the people. As Arash mentioned, it was economic people, ordinary workers who their back are bending under the expensive of eggs, meat, rice, everything, fruits, and they cannot afford to feed their families. And that was the main issues. And I would like to add that this time, the big difference is that it's more widespread and in smaller groups. We see that it started in Mashhad. Mashhad is one of the biggest Islamic center in Iran and in Shia world. Mm-hmm. And you would think that there are lots of supports for government's ideology in Mashhad. But why it started in Mashhad? Because the economy is so bad and workers and ordinary people couldn't put up anymore with these things.
I think another feature that's quite interesting this round is that the protests are widespread. It's also in places where there are ethnic minorities such as Baluchis in the southeast, Kurds in the west, lots of Arabs in Ahvaz in Khuzestan in the southwest of Iran. And again, their slogans was economic.
Who exactly are they targeting at the moment? Who are the main people that people are angry with, Roja?
Pretty much everyone in the government, in the regime. Previously, you might argue that there is a difference between government and there is a difference between regime. We have a supreme leader who is in charge of the whole regime. Ali Khamenei is controlling the hardliners policy and everything. And we have a president who is in charge of the government. Rouhani is kind of tending towards reformists. It targets President Rouhani, it targets the supreme leader, targets the head of the spokesman of the parliament, judiciary system, everyone who was in charge in the government and in the regime.
Just to illustrate it, when the demonstration spread to Tehran, students at Tehran University were shouting, "Esla talab usulgara degar tamam shod majera," which means reformists, hardliners, the story is over. They're basically targeting the whole of the establishment. And that's what's caused confusion.
Usually when these kind of protests happen in Iran, people know exactly what they want. Is that what you're seeing and witnessing right now in Iran with the protests?
That's another unusual feature of the protest. The wide variety of slogans that we hear being shouted on the streets, it sort of shows that there is no clear direction, there is no clear focus about people's demands. Slogans such as "Marg bar Gerani," which means death to high prices. That's how it started, but then suddenly it became political, and that's something that took the establishment by surprise. When they became political, we started hearing slogans such as "Estaglal Azadi Jumhuriye Irani," which means independence, freedom, and Iranian Republic. Remember, the main slogan of the 1979 revolution was independence, freedom, Islamic Republic. That shocked people.
So basically, it started from slogans against high prices and the economic situation, and it turned into slogans against the state altogether. Roger, you are following all these developments on the social media as well. Is that something you witnessed, that kind of change on the social media as well?
That's exactly. In social media, I would like to add two other very powerful slogans, which I think it started in social media even before this protest started. Like, na Gaza, na Lebanon, janam fadai Iran. Meaning, we don't want Gaza, we don't want Lebanon, I will give my life for Iran. So it means that they fed up with the foreign policy of Iran. Iran is spending loads of amount of money on Syria, on Lebanon, on Gaza. And people are thinking, when the situation in Iran is like this, when we don't have money to feed our families, why we have to spend the money on these proxy wars in other countries? Mm. And another one is death to dictator. That like shocked everyone, because before this, no one dared so clearly to pull down the picture of Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei down and step on it. This is a taboo. This was red line, no. And this is one of the slogans that you see repeating in the streets and on social media over and over again.
So Alash, I'm going to start with you. Do you think any good can come out of this? And how hopeful are people about the outcome of these protests?
I'm a very optimistic person by nature. So I think that there is a good chance that there will be some gradual easing of the pressures that Iranians are under. Having said that, I'm not going to a betting shop and put any money on this. One thing that was very interesting was a friend of mine who sent me a message from Tehran, and it says words to the effect, the cat is out of the bag. And I think that is true. The cat is out of the bag in terms of people have had enough. The economy is so bad, and the establishment will hopefully eventually realize that they will have to deal with this.
Mm. What about you, Roger? Are you as optimistic as Arash is?
I will imagine three scenarios for this. If we think that it will lead to another revolution, for me, nothing good going to come out of revolution as we experienced more than three decades ago. The second scenario, if the regime cracks down and like lots of people put into prison, execution and everything, and they manage to control the situation, that is not a good outcome either. The third outcome is similar to what Arash said. The regime will have to go with some of the demands that people are asking. In that case, some good outcome might come out of it.
The BBC's Roja Asadi and Arash Amadi, speaking there with Farhanak Amidi on the Fifth Floor podcast from our partners at the BBC World Service. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, actors in Miami who star in Spanish-language telenovelas, but without the star treatment.
You have to be available almost all the time. That's why it's so important to have the proper conditions for those actors, because they're not able to do anything else.
Now they're getting help from a labor union. That story's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In the U.S. generally, labor unions are not as powerful as they used to be. But in Hollywood, union members still flex their bargaining muscles.
Members of the Writers Guild of America voted overwhelmingly last night to authorize a strike for the first time in 10 years. They have less than a week to work out a new
contract. That strike by the WGA last year was actually averted, but it shows the power unions continue to have in Hollywood. That is not consistent across the whole of the entertainment industry, though. Case in point, Spanish language performers, including actors who work in the U.S. on telenovelas, the super popular soap operas in Latin America and here in the States. Wilson Sayre from WLRN in Miami tells us about a small effort to change that, an effort that's having some unintended consequences abroad.
El asesino siempre es el más bueno, ¿no? El más inocente. Ese. Ese del que nadie sospecha. ¿No?
That's a scene from the telenovela Reina de Corazones. Pablo Azar plays Juanjo Garcia, a son plotting revenge for his mother's death.
I know, they think I have a good guy face. Usually I'm kind of the bad guy who becomes a good guy, or the good guy who becomes a bad guy. It's funny because I'm both in the same show.
Azar is a bit of a telenovela veteran. Along with Reina de Corazones, he's been in Aurora, Corazon Valiente, La Fan, El Cuerpo.
Very dramatic, very melodramatic.
They run every weekday for months. It's a grueling production schedule.
Sometimes you shoot 40 scenes in one single day. So it's very demanding. You have to be available almost all the time. So that's why it's so important to have the proper conditions for those actors, because they are not able to do anything else.
Azar started his acting career in Mexico.
Usually you have better conditions in the U.S. than in countries like Mexico.
But Azar says the conditions he's experienced in the U.S. are worse. That's why now he's playing a role he's never acted on TV, union organizer. And he's targeting Telemundo, a big Spanish language network that's making more of its telenovelas here in Miami. Unlike many production houses in Hollywood, Telemundo isn't a union shop. It hired a lot of contractors without benefits or overtime. Actors also didn't get payment, save for reruns. So Pablo Azar organized his fellow actors and won recognition through SAG-AFTRA, the big industry union.
There were some productions being shot in Spanish, but no one really paid attention to it. But lately, Hispanics have grown in the U.S. a lot. So that brought the attention of the people and say, hey, those Spanish-speaking projects are doing pretty well. What's going on? What's happening inside?
It is trailblazing because this is a part of the industry that really hasn't been addressed by performer unions, and it's time for that to happen.
Duncan Crabtree Ireland is SAG-AFTRA's general counsel. The union is now hammering out a new contract for roughly 600 Telemundo actors. Crabtree Ireland says the Spanish language entertainment industry has grown so fast in the U.S., they're just now getting more union representation.
It didn't start out in exactly the same place that the English language television network started out in the 50s, or that the English language, movie industry started out in the 30s and 20s.
Telemundo declined an interview for this story, but in a statement, a spokesperson said, "We have the utmost respect for our talent who breathe life into our show's characters each and every day." And there have been changes. Telemundo actors are now considered full-time employees with benefits. But some union members say they still have concerns.
There is always the threat of taking work out of the United States.
Meaning that the union push might convince Telemundo to make telenovelas in Latin America. It's cheaper. So the newly unionized actors are asking their counterparts in Latin America for solidarity, for them not to take their jobs if Telemundo moves them out of the U.S. I asked Adriana Romero about this. She's an actress in Colombia and leads the actors union there. She supports the Telemundo actors, but says her union can't prevent people from taking available jobs. But
we're going to try to make the actors understand why it's not good for us to accept those conditions. But that is going to be very, very difficult. The only way you can do it is to educate people,
She does say what's happening at Telemundo has been helpful to show the benefits of bargaining to her own members in Colombia.
It's a good step to take, and it's a good example for everyone.
Pablo Azar, the actor in Miami, also hopes the push to unionize at Telemundo might inspire other Spanish language actors to organize.
It's a wake-up call to say, hey, your work is worth equal as someone else that speaks any other language.
But Azar isn't ready to call his efforts a success yet. He's waiting for that first contract between his union and Telemundo to be sealed. For The World, Wilson Sayre, Miami.
From telenovelas to another pop culture phenomenon, people expect mariachi music to sound a certain way. But what if you're Mexican-American and you've lived your whole life in California? Can you break the rules and really put your own imprint on mariachi? Kainat Khan has a story of one musician in Fresno who's adapting this Mexican art form.
Inside a cavernous building in downtown Fresno, Omar Nare is doing a sound check on his guitar. He's about to play at a gallery opening for one of his artist friends. Omar calls his music Nuevo Mariachi, New Mariachi.
We're in a search. That's where mariachi is right now. It's searching. It's searching for what's next. It's 120 years old, and it's got to be going someplace new.
Omar isn't wearing the mariachi suit, which is called a charro. He looks trendy in a button-down shirt and jeans and boots. He stands at the mic alone. No backup singers, no trumpets or fanfare. It isn't what I imagine when I imagine mariachi. Omar is trying to find a modern take on a Mexican tradition. But maybe modern isn't the right word. Maybe a better way to say it is that Omar is trying to find a Californian take on mariachi.
Because I'm not Mexican. I was not born in Mexico. I was born in Sanger, California. I was born to a Mexican-American mom and an Arabic father.
He reveres mariachi, its history and what it represents. But Omar was disillusioned by how mariachi had kind of stalled.
I saw many of the same songs get played in the same way by every mariachi band and every Mexican restaurant that has a mariachi. I think that we should be allowed to adapt and change. That's really what it's about for me. Yeah,
to understand Omar's search and where he is going with Nuevo Mariachi, we have to learn about where he comes from.
Well, right now we're on the 180.
Omar drives me to Sanger, California, the small town about 20 minutes outside Fresno, where he grew up. This is the heart of California's Central Valley. It's where a quarter of the food Americans eat is grown. Flat stretches of fruit trees framed by mountains in the distance. The valley's existence is inextricably bound up with agriculture and the Mexican farm laborers who came here to work. Omar's grandfather was one of them.
So they came in to work the land over, and my grandfather came first. And my grandma was... every tree, every plant she knew. Not me. I wish that's a knowledge that I lost, which is a knowledge that I wish that I did. But I know what it's like to work in the fields. I've definitely been in the trees picking fruit, having a branch poke at your back. You know? This is the house.
We arrive at Omar's Mexican grandfather's ranch, where we meet Omar's Uncle Ruben, who now owns the house. Omar grew up hearing Mexican music, and his tío Ruben taught him his first mariachi songs.
He was very small, and then I had the guitar, and we're just playing some crazy little simple tunes, and he starts to sing like, and I saw that in him immediately. I knew he had the voice to sing. So I was trying to surprise his mom, my sister. And then when we threw a party at the house, he goes ahead, okay, I'm like, go ahead and sing. And he starts singing it to the family, and that's where everything started.
Llego a mi casa vacía y tranco la puerta.
When Omar and his family discovered he had a talent, he went from singing at family gatherings to playing gigs as a child mariachi singer. He started traveling and performing multiple gigs on weekends around the state.
I do remember one time we were driving. I think that we had done a show in Parlier, and the sun was hitting the stage. I was roasting, and I was wearing leather pants. I got off the stage, we ran to the car because we had to go to some other type of gig. And I just remember that I was in the back seat and my mom was laughing at me, cracking up at me because I could not get the pants off to change into my other outfit, you know. That's what it was like though, changing in the car, pull over, there's a road stop, gotta change, put something else on so you look fresh, wipe your face down. Do you have your sound system? Yeah. We got all the cables? Okay, next gig. Next gig. It was a grind.
At one of these gigs, when Omar was about 16 or 17, a producer for Sony Music approached him and his family about recording a demo tape and making Omar a Latin pop star. So Omar and his mom flew to Italy to record these new tracks with professional producers and songwriters. But it wasn't what they were expecting. Omar remembers seeing explicit photos on the walls, and his mom recalls being hit on. It wasn't the environment she wanted for him.
We wanted the best for him, and at that point, that wasn't the best for him.
Omar went to college pretty soon after returning from Italy. After he got his degree from Fresno State, he went back to being a working musician, but not a mariachi. He played in a salsa band, a reggaeton band.
At one point, I think I was playing in 12 bands.
He didn't come back to mariachi until years later, as Omar tells it, after a conversation with a friend from Mexico City, who told him,
Omar, para la juventud en México, el mariachi está muerto.
For the young people of Mexico City, mariachi is dead.
That punched me in my gut. It really hurt me And I started to remember my youth. And I thought to myself, mariachi is this cultural identity. Yeah, I ran away from it. I get that. But to say that the music sucks, it really punched me in my gut. That was the seed.
Querida, la noche está tan fría.
Around the same time he had that conversation, Omar played a show for Eva Longoria's charity. That's right, the Mexican-American actress. At an after-party, the musicians passed around a guitar. When they asked Omar to play...
Don't ask me why, but I started singing mariachi songs. Y volver, volver, volver. Eva Longoria came out of her house and was just like listening, doing gritos, eso, canta, you know, like 4 a.m. party. Afterwards, she came up to me and she says, that's what makes you special. Keep doing that.
Those two interactions inspired Omar to revisit the music of his childhood. Omar started trying to figure out if he could, as he often said, add a new branch to the old tree of mariachi.
Querida, yo te necesito aquí a mi lado, por favor, querida. Regresa con tu amor.
I haven't understood exactly what about Nueva Mariachi is new. Omar recently did a cover of a famous mariachi song called Sabor a Mi. I asked him what he changed about the song that made it Nueva Mariachi.
Sabor a Mi was written many years ago, and it's a classic bolero. It's been covered by everybody. Da-da-da. Sabor a mí. We've heard it a million times. First thing that I did is I fell back on my training and I looked at the melody notes. And I just started playing with chords because I wanted to take away this jolly feeling that I had, you know, and I changed the feeling.
Tanto tiempo disfrutamos de este amor, nuestras almas se acercaron tanto así.
There, like it feels like a different song.
Tanto tiempo disfrutamos de este amor, nuestras almas se acercaron tanto así, que yo guardo tu sabor, pero tú llevas también sabor a mí.
Si negaras... I want Sabor a Mí, this version, to become my symbol of what I plan to do with Nuevo Mariachi. We take something that's classic, we reinterpret it through this new lens, and out comes something completely different.
I ask Omar whether his grandfather would like Nuevo Mariachi.
I think that if my grandfather was alive, I think there's still enough mariachi in my mariachi that he would love it.
No soy nada, yo no tengo vanidad. Doy lo bueno, soy tan pobre que otra cosa puedo dar.
Love this tune. Kainat Khan's story about Omar Nare is an excerpt from the podcast, The New American Songbook. It's produced with support from the Ground Truth Project right here at WGBH and from Mass Humanities. For the full podcast and more of Omar's music, head over to PRI.org. Here's an update to the story of the world's most opulent prison. You remember back in November when about 200 royals and businessmen in Saudi Arabia were rounded up in a so-called anti-corruption probe? They were held at the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh. Among those arrested and still being held is a Saudi billionaire, Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal.
He is considered to be probably
the most wealthy investor in all of the Middle East and certainly in Saudi Arabia.
That's Jake Novak of CNBC. Novak has been watching as some of Saudi Arabia's wealthiest people are released from detention at the Ritz-Carlton. There's much speculation that the Saudi government has collected lots of money from the wealthy detainees.
There's really no way of knowing, but we do know what some of the big fish are being asked to pay. There was one other prince who was asked to pay $1 billion, and he paid it.
Which brings us to bin Talal. He's said to be the 45th richest man on earth, worth between $12 and $20 billion, and he's very high profile.
He is a frequent guest on all the major financial networks, my own included, CNBC.
And CNN and Bloomberg and Fox, and that may be why he's being held. Not necessarily because he's corrupt or a political maverick. After all, bin Talal supports positions held by the crown prince who had him detained. He endorses the crown prince's progressive business and social policies. No, says Novak, it's got to be something else.
This could be just, in the case of bin Talal, not so much a case of him being on the wrong side of an issue or committing a crime, but just being too conspicuous and too wealthy and needing to be taken down a peg in the mind of the new crown prince.
But why, Novak wonders, are so few people in the financial world asking about this missing billionaire? He's friends with Bill Gates, friends with Rupert Murdoch. Last year, bin Talal flew to Silicon Valley and met with Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. Novak says that no one involved in financial markets wants to upset the Saudis at this time. There's a really big deal in the works.
Look, Saudi Aramco, which is the Saudi Arabian basically oil company, which is going to go IPO probably later this year, is worth $2 trillion, maybe more, to certain investors. Nobody wants to mess with the Saudi government right now when there are chances to get in a little bit more on this IPO. So it's really, really good timing for bin Salman, the new crown prince, to basically say, look, if you guys want to play with us, you're going to have to basically be quiet about what's going on here.
And then there's Twitter. President Trump's favorite social media platform is owned in part by the detained bin Talal.
To me, that's even probably the most damning factor of all, is that here you have, you know, a social media platform that's become one of the most widely read and used all over the world platforms, and they're not talking about him either. I think the Twitter must believe that no matter what happens to bin Talal, his investment money will either be taken over by somebody else in the Saudi family, or he'll eventually be released and everything will go back to normal. And it just goes to show that you have to really be careful about overestimating your personal value to the companies and the associates that you make in business.
Jake Novak is a senior editorial columnist at CNBC.com. We reached out to Twitter, which said it had no comment at this time, and to the Saudi Arabian embassy in Washington, which reminded us that, quote, Saudi privacy laws do not allow the embassy to be privy to specific individuals' information. Let's wrap up today with an A-side, B-side from the world's Brandy Fullwood, another way the show makes those connections for you between in here and out there. You know how this works. Brandy picks a track from the massive collection at the Smithsonian's Folklife Center, and that leads her to another track that she's been listening to lately. Here's Brandy with A-side, B-side.
There's something about Stamboul Naturel that's really familiar. Okay, the guitar and ukulele are definitely part of that, but it has a lot to do with pacing and language for me. It's from the Smithsonian Folkways Archives, and it's performed by Usman Ahmad and Diswan Soni. The album explores a few ways that guitar music is made in Indonesia, specifically Lampung, Sumatra. Usman's vocals are both smooth and warm. They weave themselves in between the guitar's bright and happy notes, giving balance throughout the entire song. The pacing is subtly varied, and at times the vocals chase the instrumental or trail slightly behind them. There's a switch between catching up and going against the twinkling strings. With the B-side, it's an experimental folk song from Lima, Peru, but it has a similar relationship between voice and instrumental.
Entre los recovecos del azar, pude ahuyentar la soledad, inculcada en mí por una fuerza ajena.
Beatrice by Camille Jackson is cloudier than Stamboul Naturel, and the lyrics are also whispered. But where they're similar is where the voice stretches over a persistent beat or dashes in between them.
Te escapaste sola de tu tristeza, y yo tengo que dejar la melancolía.
Each song, at first, has words that adhere to the guitar, but eventually glide into their own emotional tone. The softer, rounded vowels and swallowed consonants may also have a lot to do with the similarity of these two songs. Initially, I heard this in Stamboul Naturel because, well, I'm not familiar with the language. So it made it easier to note the relationship of sounds between vocal and instrumental without knowing the words first. With Beatrice, I found that much like Stamboul Naturel, it manages to weave and vary tones, while the instrumental is persistent and upbeat. The vocal performance finds its own space alongside it, or wanders off on its own. For The World, I'm Brandy Fullwood.
Donde todo se quema rápido. Es inútil caer en la pureza.
This music is part of Future Folk, our collaboration with the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. And that's all for us this week. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
De mi cabeza, de mi cabeza.
PRI, Public Radio International.